and welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce, and this is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I have two wonderful guests here in the studio with me. They're actually social justice and peace students over at King's, learning about all of this stuff. And today's show is about austerity, and it is the buzzword, the word that IMF is shoving down the world's throats, and wanting all of Canadians and everyone around the world to pay back all of the money that they artificially made us owe. So this is the show. And, so we're going to talk about this, and we're going to talk about it on a local level. And, London Council is here in London and doing, their bit about, London Council, trying to get that 0% tax increase and slashing the dickens out of social services in the process. And we just got rid of McGuinty, who is austerity McGuinty, and we've got Harper, and on this show we love Harper. Yeah, off with his head. So, and then we're going to talk more on an international level. And, there are countries that have told the IMF where to go, and they're doing quite well. So just to start this thing off and get rolling, we've got a clip that, tells you what austerity means. And it's going to define it for you.
It's an old trick to couch a painful reality inside of a flowery platitude. We hear it all the time in our daily lives, and for the most part, we know how to read between the lines when someone tries to do it to us. When your doctor tells you that this will only hurt a bit, you know enough to brace yourself for a painful procedure. When your boss tells you that he has an exciting new project for you to work on, you know you're about to get saddled with a job that no one else wants to do. When a salesman tells you that a used car is a fixer-upper, you know that you're looking at a lemon. Similarly, when the IMF tells a nation that they need to implement austerity in order to get themselves out of a financial crisis, here too lies a gaping chasm between the language and the reality. Austerity is one of those Orwellian terms that has been injected into our political discourse precisely because it is a nice-sounding word for a very painful reality. Austerity implies discipline, self-restraint, even nobility. Austerity is prudent. Austerity is modest. Austerity is a virtue. It is an end in itself. If the IMF or the European Central Bank come to the people of a collapsing European nation and tell them to sacrifice their pensions and their savings and their very standard of living, all for a debt that their government has fraudulently racked up in their name, no one would go for it, and rightly so. But tell those same people that they need to implement austerity measures in order to get back on their feet economically, and many will be willing to live in the harshest of conditions, content to put up with the dismantling of their nation itself, in the vain hope that by giving more power to the international financial institutions, they can somehow avoid economic collapse. The trick, of course, is that reality is completely the opposite. Like the doctor giving you false assurances that this will only hurt a bit, the economic amputation that the bankers have in store for the once proud nations of the industrialized world will be excruciating.
How's it going, guys?
Just ask anyone in the third world. They should know. They've been going through these austerity plans for decades.
I can hear you.
Ask the people of Ethiopia if the IMF World Bank economic therapy of the 1990s worked in their nation's favor. Ask them about the fire sale of state assets, public utilities, farms, and factories for pennies on the dollar to multinational corporations. Ask them how U.S. aid helped to dump surplus genetically engineered crops that couldn't be sold in Europe on poor African nations as charitable food aid. The extent of the horrors inflicted on Ethiopia by the international financiers almost beggars description. The banksters weren't content to carve the country into pieces and sell the scraps to their big business cronies. They then had the audacity to steal the very food off the poor farmers' tables and replace it with GM Frankenfoods that the rest of the world wouldn't even touch. This is the real face of austerity. It is nothing less than economic slavery to an elite group of banksters who have created their own fiat wealth out of thin air. Nor is Ethiopia the only example of this procedure. Quite the contrary. A similar process has played itself out in almost every country that the international finance oligarchs have tried to set straight with their procedures that will only hurt a little. In Brazil, IMF reforms actually altered the nature of the Brazilian constitution, halting transfers of federal funds to state governments so that those funds could be used to pay the bankers their pound of flesh. The IMF structural adjustment program in Peru devastated the local agricultural economy and made illegal coca production the only viable way for many farmers to make a living. From the first IMF-sponsored economic reform package in Peru in 1978 to the second round of IMF reforms in the early 90s, coca production increased over 400%. A $4.8 billion IMF loan to Russia in the late 90s never even made it into Russian coffers, with billions being deposited directly into offshore bank accounts connected to mobsters, politicians, and banksters. Despite the fact that the Russian people did not see a single ruble of the siphoned money, they were still responsible for paying it back to the international bankers who were kind enough to lend it to them at interest. Time and time again, in country after country, in every corner of the globe, IMF loans spell disaster for the people who are left holding the bag. The crux of the entire issue is that none of this is unexpected. In fact, it is part of the design of the IMF austerity programs themselves. As revealed by Joseph Stiglitz, the former chief economist of the World Bank, the IMF's modus operandi is to conduct economic raids of debtor nations, dismantling and selling off infrastructure for the benefit of foreign corporations, and making sure that all public money is used to pay off the bankers. He even has a name for what happens after the austerity plan inevitably results in the dissolution of a society: the IMF riot. Bolivians rioted over water prices, Indonesians rioted over food and fuel subsidies, Ecuadorians rioted over cooking gas prices, Argentinians rioted over the complete collapse of their once rich nation. The common denominator in all of these cases were austerity measures and the IMF. Now, the beginnings of IMF riots are shaping up in Europe. People are taking to the streets to protest the measures that are about to be taken in the name of paying back to the banksters what corrupt governments stole from the people. On the other side stand the police, increasingly militarized and deployed in the service of the banksters and the politicians. The battle lines are forming. But is there another way out? Can the people of Europe learn from the examples of Iceland? That tiny North Atlantic island nation, too, found itself facing complete bankruptcy as the derivatives-fueled bubble of the Icelandic financial sector burst in the wake of Lehman Brothers. The people were once again left holding the bag for billions of dollars in debts owed to foreign banks, and the quiet streets of sleepy Reykjavik were erupting in violence. But in Iceland, the people did not fight the government. They became the government. A populist people movement forced the early collapse of Iceland's government, and non-politicians were swept into power. They held a referendum in which the people overwhelmingly rejected the idea that they were going to pay billions of dollars to foreign bankers for a debt that was not theirs. It was fraudulent, and they will not pay it. It remains to be seen whether the G20 nations will be able to follow the Icelandic example as the rot begins to eat away at the economies of the rich, industrialized nations. The first test of this may happen as early as this week, at the G8 G20 in Toronto, where the political puppets of the Canadian government have indebted the Canadian people by a staggering $1 billion to pay for a totalitarian police state operation that will inevitably provoke such mindless, violent reactions. We stand at a crossroads where the people can rise up in mass against the financial oligarchs who are puppeteering this downfall and get rid of the political puppets of both the left and the right who fall into lockstep with the vultures of Wall Street no matter who sits in the White House. Or, not understanding what is happening or who is really behind it, the people can be led into senseless acts of violence against black-suited policemen in battles that will not address the root of the problem but will lead to pain and suffering. The first step is to nurture the understanding that the austerity offered by the bankers is not the solution to our problems, but the beginning of them. Then we will know what it means when the IMF tells us this will only hurt a bit. For the Corbett Report in Western Japan, I am James Corbett.
And that gives you just, you know, a little bit of clear as mud on austerity. gives you the point of framing for this show, anyways. And I'm just going to let these two lovely ladies introduce themselves to you.
All right, my name is Sydney Bergeron.
I'm Aurora Fitzgerald.
And you two are at King's.
Yes.
And this show kind of came out of a project at school?
Yeah. We have our project with SJP. It's one where we do work in the community, working with different organizations, getting experience, and getting out there. So we've learned a lot, and we had somebody come to the class to speak with us. Her name's Joni Beckler, city councilor here, and she really, really got us interested in starting to participate in local stuff.
Okay, so you guys were, you're up on the Fontana cry for 0%.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah?
A little bit.
So, having worked on it there. And for those that don't know, our mayor here in London, Ontario, got elected 2 years ago under the pretense that he was going to produce a 0% budget for the next 4 years and that he wouldn't run again.
Thank God.
Yeah. So, he did deliver 0% in year one.
Yeah.
And we're now here at year two. And we have a short clip here of Fontana last year speaking to the Chamber of Commerce about his 0%.
Some thought his 0% tax freeze was unattainable. But a majority of London voters wanted us to try. Our actions have included freezing sewer and water rates for 1 year and finding savings in the city budget. The results, well, they've been good. And I'm pleased to announce today that we are within $2.4 million or 0.6% from achieving our goal. That's going from $13 million already to $2.4. And I want to thank council, the men and women in this city, and avoid the sacrifice so that we can attain that goal.
And that doesn't sound anything like it's only going to hurt a little.
Yeah. I like the part where he says, I thank you for sacrificing.
The thing with that is that it's usually the people who are in the least powerful positions in society that have to sacrifice the most. And that's quite painful.
Let's talk about that. Who's sacrificing here in London?
And everybody, almost. And he says the majority of London, we're talking about women, we're talking about children, we're talking about the elderly, we're talking about people who don't make a ton of money, new immigrants, students, a lot of people, almost everyone, except for the mayor.
And the 1%.
Yeah, the 1%.
I didn't want to throw out an Occupy term for everybody.
Yeah, no, we're very Occupy around here. we're anti-austerity. We're very much for the people and human rights. And, that's what this show is all about is, if you want to listen to the other side of the coin, there's the other one on Thursdays.
Yeah.
So, and they'll give you the other side of the coin. So, we kind of cling with our fingernails to the cliff at the left. And, we're quite happy there.
Yeah. Take our hour.
That's right. So, when we talk about austerity, I mean, typically we're talking about, nobody wants to know what the government's doing. So the government, as soon as a government says austerity, that they're going to stop the press from understanding what's happening.
Yeah.
Right? And, and then they're going to start cutting social supports to women, youth, seniors, it's all going to be about paying back this debt or servicing a debt or in the case of the City of London, the lack of transfer payments from the province, right? Which is all about the debt.
Yeah.
Right? So in your research and the stuff you've been doing, what has the city done to us?
Well, the 0%, I think it sounds nice, and I think a lot of people say, yeah, great, we don't raise our taxes. That's because people are working hard. They don't want to pay more money. But the reality is, if you don't raise taxes, at least at the rate of inflation, then you're constantly losing money. We have less and less money to work with every year. And, I guess it's fine if you don't want to pay taxes, but for me personally, I support social services. I want to ride public transit. I believe in making quality of life better. So, I mean, you have to pay taxes. You have to have social support. And cutting that really leaves us in a difficult position.
And, you know, the inflation rate's what, around 2% officially?
3%, I think.
Yeah, and then, you know, the unofficial rate that is what we figure at about 7%-ish that is actual inflation that we're facing here in Canada. So you know, we're 3% behind.
Every year.
So every year.
And I think it compounds a little bit.
Yeah, so 2 years, 6% behind.
Yeah.
So, you know, it adds up. So this is hurting people, and you know, it's not hurting the guy on you know, the ninth tee off. Right?
Nope.
But, you know, who...
Unless he rides the bus.
Unless he rides the bus with his clubs. And, you know, I ride the bus, and I haven't seen too many golf clubs on the bus.
Lots of strollers.
Lots of strollers, mm-hmm. and you know... And
people carrying groceries.
You know, handicap access, yeah. and
poor
seniors.
Students. Yeah.
And students, yeah. You know, the next poverty-ish community of Canada are students.
Oh, yeah.
Educated, but impoverished. Yeah.
So, you know, you got to pay off these student debts and, you know, debt. And, you know, debt makes people controlled. And, you know, that's what austerity is all about, is controlling populations.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the mayor covers it up nicely. But what he's not saying is that by not increasing taxes and keeping to the 0%, we're actually putting ourselves farther in debt. So we're cutting things that actually increase the quality of life to pay for debt that we're creating for no reason. It seems crazy to me.
Yep. So talk about this. What, I mean, we're all on the same page that social services actually save money.
Yes.
Right? And we've seen this in health. We've seen this in homelessness, you know, housing first projects where we house people first, regardless of anything, you know, they thrive and then they suck less taxes.
Yes.
They can contribute actually to paying taxes because they can get jobs and focus on other things in life and participate in the economy.
So when you drive down welfare rates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of people don't understand that welfare is $500 a month.
Yeah, wow. It just got brought down to that. Yeah,
it's
a little over.
So
you can't live.
You on $500 a month, you cannot get an apartment for less than $400 in this city.
Yeah, I know that too. I am a home owner who rents out to students, and I can There's just no way to pay the bills for the person who owns the house or the apartment who's renting it. You can't bring it down.
And where I'm doing my experiential learning, actually, I get a lot of experience with that sort of stuff. A lot of women, because I'm working at a sort of a women's shelter, they'll come in and they will be paying for their rent, and all of the welfare will go to that, and then they'll have to take public transit to go around to food banks to feed themselves. So that kind of relates back to if we cut public transit, which they've decided not to do, thankfully, yet. But, it highlights the importance of social services such as public transit.
Yeah, and it's a domino effect, right?
Yeah.
If a mom can't get proper nutrition for her child, that child does not have the same opportunity to grow and develop their mind to the best of their ability. They're crippled for life. They're unable to flourish, and that just hurts our city more in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, you don't always get a bus pass when you're on welfare.
No.
You have to have X number of appointments per month before they will issue you a bus pass.
And the issue with that is a lot of people can't make it to the appointments, especially
because they can't get there.
That's just it.
Yeah, I'm a psychotherapist, and I see clients all the time, and a good portion of my people are on welfare, and I get cancellations constantly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't have a bus ticket.
Yeah,
I cannot get to your appointment. I just don't have it. And you know, so I'm trying to help this person get back on their feet, go work through their issues, and get back as a contributing member of society. They all want off social assistance. They want to have productive means and abilities, but they're in this position, and some of them got there themselves. Some you know, other factors have
of
put
course,
them there,
yeah,
right?
Cycle of poverty.
Yeah, it's exactly. And, you know, but they cannot get the therapy that they need because they don't have a $2 bus ticket.
Yeah.
It seems you face a lot of resistance when trying to help people like this. It's not an easy task to face.
So that's what we're facing with. And in London, you know, they're pretty close to their 0% this time.
Good job.
Good job.
Good job, Mr. Mayor.
Yep. So,
pretty much everything is suffering. We're not going to have new buses. They wanted to cut certain bus routes, but they're not doing. They're not going to invest in infrastructure downtown. They want to shut down the library services even more. So, yeah. Everybody wins.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And Sundays, which, you know, are the worst time for people that are marginalized because a lot of the programs aren't open. There's no support. So, I mean, I run a crisis line, and Sunday is my busiest day on the crisis line because people are stranded. They have nothing to do. They don't have, so they start belly gazing, as I call it, and start realizing how crappy their life is. And then they're thinking about suicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, suicide costs billions of dollars.
Well, yeah. And I mean, nobody wants to feel useless. Nobody wants to feel like they're not contributing, because I think we get a really great sense from helping others and being involved, and
nobody wakes up one morning and says, you know, I'm just going to off myself. Sounds like a great thing to do.
Yeah,
you know, it's the entire social network that creates that issue. So let's talk a little bit more. Okay, London, as far as I'm concerned, is in trouble.
Yeah.
Right, and the austerity measures that council is attempting. I mean, nobody wants to pay more taxes, and let's face it, we pay too many as it is. But, you know, I think they need to be looking besides social programs to save money. You know, they spent billions and billions of dollars on things that, you know, are questionable.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, not everything that you can spend money for social issues or causes is necessarily a social support program. You know, cutting funding to make bike lanes, for instance. Portland, Oregon just invested, I think it was 5% of their budget, it was about $7 million in biking infrastructure, and they had a return of $90 million, so over 10 times what they invested. And that's not a social program, but you're saving money and you're making money, and it's just investing in infrastructure. You know, so there's definitely smart ways to invest your money that help social causes without being a social program.
Absolutely. And we're going to play a clip on Sweden here.
Okay.
And Sweden is one of the countries that told the IMF where to go.
And how to get there.
And how to get there. And we're going to play this clip here.
Unlike many of its European neighbors, Sweden is enjoying a period of relative prosperity. The foundation stone for its present success was laid in the late 30s. A historic agreement between employers' associations and trade unions founded a new economic model. The so-called third way, a middle way between capitalism and socialism. The key concepts of the new era: negotiation, consensus, and transparency.
It's a long tradition of making information public, so this is not a recent phenomenon. And this offentlighetsprincip, this principle of having decision-making processes and public records transparent and open is a very long one. And a very important feature of how the sort of democratic system has later been sort of working.
The main areas of reform in Sweden have been family politics, care of the elderly, pensions, the healthcare system, and immigration policies. Since the 70s, Sweden has operated an active equal opportunities policy that's had a big impact here. One area in which Sweden has been successful is their family policy. Many Swedish women work, and that's partly because parental leave is fairly generous. Most Swedes are now starting in kindergarten when they are a year old. The full integration of women into the labour market is a matter of course in Sweden today. With nearly 77% of women being gainfully employed, it is significantly above the European average. Equal pay for equal work is a legal requirement and is put into practice. The decisive factor that allows women to work full-time is the well-developed public childcare system. The state spends two-thirds of its family budget on the expansion and maintenance of the daycare centres and schools. Only about a third of the money goes directly to parents. Private allowances for childcare are strictly graded according to income, number of children, and duration of care. This focus on women not only gives the Swedes more options, it also helps to boost the state revenue.
We have changed the tax system, so we have separated taxation of male and second and first earner, which means that the income of the second earner is taxed much lower than it used to be before the 1970s. It's also connected to the fact that we have heavy subsidies to the child care system, which makes it possible not only for high-income women, but also for low-income women to combine care responsibilities with work on the market. So we have much strong importance of women on the labor market and as taxpayers. So they are also, of course, contributing to the tax base.
Elderly care in Sweden is the responsibility of the state. Since the 1950s, there has been no obligation for children to pay maintenance for their parents.
Hello. Kom jag med lite.
In the wake of the welfare reform in the 90s, the expansion of the expensive nursing home system was cancelled and changed to a less expensive home care system. Nursing homes are only available for people who need 24-hour care. Instead, Annalisa Carlander gets a half-hour visit from a supervisor three times a day. Every elderly person in Sweden today has the right to home care and has to pay only a small fraction of the cost out of their own pocket. In addition to the massive cuts in social spending, during the drastic austerity measures of the 90s, pensions were reformed. The Swedes recognised that two factors made the existing system cost prohibitive. First, the baby boom generation are approaching retirement age in large number. Also, people are living longer. Earlier than many other European countries, Sweden reacted and in 1999 converted its pension system.
In the early days, we had fixed promises to the pensioners. Regardless of the economic situation in the state, their pensions were regulated from the original part, and it was just automatically counted up to proper amounts or things like that. So it was not automatic. Everybody knew how much pension he or she should have for the rest of his life, regardless of how long he or she would live. And it's obvious that this system cannot survive with the demographic changes we do have in our population, as in most nations. So now we have another system. So the new system is that the pensioners of tomorrow will get as much pension as the taxpayers at that time are able to pay.
In the wake of the great crisis in the 90s, Sweden has also reformed its health system. The overriding principle was to keep the quality of primary care. A central administration created more efficiency and lower costs. They have created conditions in Sweden and also in the hospitals, encouraging the idea that the patient moves from hospital to a secure home care situation. That is, I believe, already a step forward. It is also making things cheaper, which is very difficult. What I can envisage as a doctor is that one could send patients to intermediate spaces, nursing places, where they don't use the so-called high standards needed at a central hospital, but still the basic care and basic needs of the patients are met. That way, they could certainly save money, I believe. Sweden has a long tradition as a country that welcomes immigration. The 60s were a decade of a great wave of immigration, with an annual influx of 30,000 to 60,000 workers. For 20 years, there prevailed among the Social Democrats a very welcoming immigration policy. But with the two large waves of refugees from Iraq and the Balkan Wars, the Swedish policy changed radically. Sweden has made its borders more and more impenetrable. Today, the Swedish policy, far more than in the rest of Europe, tries to see integration as an obligation of the immigrant and their citizenship as a debt to society. It turns out that foreigners who come to Sweden are integrated much faster, are integrated much better, and will often find work in communities where there is a better environment for entrepreneurs and growth. This is because they can easily start new companies and also often find employment. Following the radical reforms of the 90s, the social system in Sweden today works just as well as before, but overall is cheaper. And because after this decade of saving, the state budget is balanced again, the Swedish didn't feel the financial and economic crisis of 2008 as much as other nations. It can cut taxes and boost the economy with it. In 2010, while many other European countries were still struggling with the consequences of this crisis, Sweden recorded the highest economic growth for more than 30 years. The fight against youth unemployment, the rebuilding of the school system, and the attempt to solve the immigration problem constructively will all be future challenges for Sweden. But in comparison to many other countries, on the whole, Sweden has a lot of confidence in its policies. Reductions in state benefits have been designed so cleverly that the Swedes are still satisfied. And whilst most European countries groan under the debt crisis, Sweden is becoming an increasingly competitive economy.
And we'll be back after these messages with Sydney and Aurora talking about austerity measures on CHRW 94.9 FM. And we're back at Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce, and I have two wonderful guests here from the King's Social Justice and Peace Program, Sydney and Aurora. Thanks, guys. So, you know, that Sweden's austerity plan or non-austerity plan, and you know, through that clip, you know, you guys cringed a little, you know, because... us, and they say that, you know, they balanced somewhere between.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So somewhere between.
Somewhere between, you know. They have issues with, I mean, when seniors have to work.
Yeah.
You know, those are taking the jobs away from youth. Right? Because
well,
those are the same jobs, typically.
And poor grandpa, you know, barely see. He's in, you know, the sweatshop, sewing away. I don't know what they actually make them do.
Well, you know, but they work till they die to pay for stuff, so...
Stuff.
So, here's a clip about Ontario, and, you know, and the Drummond Report, and McGuinty's government, and you know, there's some distinct differences between Sweden and Ontario and the effects, so let's compare them.
Okay.
Third up, we have Sheila Block.
I work at a place called the Wellesley Institute, and our focus is on the social determinants of health, what are sometimes called the causes of ill health. And the McGuinty government, in tasking the Drummond Commission to kind of come up with a human face and austerity agenda, specifically excluded the Ministry of Health budget. And I think one of the things that we've really wanted to be talking about over the last little area is that the impact that governments have on health move far beyond what's happening or isn't happening in health budgets. And I'm just going to back up a little bit to tell you, remind you of the epidemiological evidence that's really clear that other social factors, racism, sexism, employment, housing, those kinds of issues have a very concrete impact on people's lives. And Statistics Canada evidence shows us that the lower income you are in Canada, the shorter your lifespan. And more recently, we've had some pretty interesting research that says it's not only whether you're low income, but how much inequality you have around you and how much inequality you're surrounded by that has that kind of an impact on a large number of health outcomes. So the second thing I want to talk about a little bit here is just the gender impacts. And there are really 3 to 4 ways that the proposed cutbacks have a differential impact on women as compared to men. And the first thing to remember about this is that women make up about 60% of public servants. There are 4 ways. One is the loss of public sector employment. What that results in is an increase in unemployment and more unemployment for women than for men because there are more women who are public servants. In the second instance, if you are unemployed and you're looking for employment in the private sector rather than in the public sector because your job has been contracted out or doesn't exist anymore, public sector employment for women's wages and public sector employment are higher than women's wages and private sector employment, and men's wages in public sector employment are lower than it is in the private sector. What that shows is that if you're moving a larger number of women from the public sector into the private sector, you're moving them into lower paid jobs. And so their chances after they leave are worse than the chances for men after they've left the public sector. You're also seeing what is often referred to in health sector spending of a shift out into the community, and that has, you know, kind of those warm, fuzzy feelings about, you know, being closer to people. And in fact, what that, and this is a sector, the health sector is a sector where the 82% of employment is actually of women. And what that means is you move out of larger institutions where you are more likely to be unionized, and if you are unionized, you're more likely to have higher wages, better benefits, including a pension, and moving out to the community sector where if you are unionized, you're going to have lower wages and you're going to have less benefits than you would in the larger institutions. So we have a loss of jobs, we have a decrease in the quality of jobs, and then we have who picks up the slack when we lose those services. And what we do know is that it is women who the responsibility for caregiving, either in the paid sector or in the unpaid sector, falls. You're losing paid work, you're doing that work in an unpaid manner, and then the kind of work that continues to be available for you will actually be lower paid work. I took a look at some of the StatsCan data that looked at the share of women's income in husband-wife families of total. And I think what would be interesting, at least to some people in the crowd, is that there has been, of course, an increase in the number of families where women's wages are more than 50%. But also in Ontario, those increases are most pronounced in the areas where manufacturing has really been hollowed out. So if you look at Windsor, if you look at London, it's those areas that women's wages are most important. And often if those are public sector employment, wages from public sector employment, you're really kind of sustaining both those families and those communities. I think that there is a real lesson for us to just move further down the road of despair in looking at what's happened in austerity plans in the UK, where they are further along in the road to austerity. They have a women's unemployment rate in England that is higher than it has been in 25 years. And you have massive cutbacks to the kinds of services and women, both women's employment and the services that women rely on. So I guess my note of hope will be that perhaps we'll see the reemergence of the Canadian feminist movement in response to these cutbacks. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, so in comparison, you know, Sweden put laws in place that guaranteed equal pay for women. They support women to stay in the workplace. They have a higher percentage of women working in private enterprise, and the country flourishes. In Ontario, we have no pay equality for women in any way, shape, or form. We still have them trying to shut down government service and offload people into private enterprise where women are paid less. And instead of having measures that bring prosperity to the country by bringing women in and allowing women to contribute to society in the great ways that we can, it's a war against women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say how ridiculous it is. It's
it's funny because you know, using words like austerity, like euphemisms are the government's best friend, right? You get people to agree to basically give up their power to determine their own lives. And it's kind of scary that they have that kind of ability. But, just blows my mind.
Yeah, and we look at Harper. You know, the very first move that he made when he came into office was to close the women's offices.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Of course. Why give them any power?
He instantly gave tax breaks to second-income families who the second partner stops working,
okay.
Which, you know, is usually the woman
mm-hmm.
in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so gives breaks to force more single family mom stays at home and, you know, barefoot and pregnant type scenario.
It's very patriarchal.
Yeah, you know, and you know, that is wonderful for some moms.
For sure.
Awesome. But there's a large percentage that like to feel value.
Well, I mean, outside of the family, for sure.
There's a lot of women who drive a lot of value out of being a mother and staying at home, and that's fine. But you know, I think the women's movement in Canada has proven that not every woman wants to do that. We want to have the ability to choose whether or not. And I mean, great that he wants to help a parent stay home with their children. That's fantastic. But at the same time, you're really facilitating a situation in which women feel pressure to not work in order to help their family. And that's a very complex way to stick women back in the home.
Exactly. It's really enforcing, you know, gender stereotypes there.
Yeah, he's tricky, that Harper.
He is.
Slippery devil.
You know, he's everything he does has a motive, right?
Yeah. Well, he's a politician, right?
Oh,
yeah.
But he's not a politician that's good for Canada. He's
definitely
he's a politician
not.
That's got an agenda, and that, I mean, that agenda is an austerity agenda,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's an agenda to suck Canada dry while he's got power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's going to suck our water, suck our resources, suck our oil, suck our...
Well, he's going to let China do it.
Well, that's just it, right?
Well, China's just the top bidder.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If it wasn't China, it would be insert other country,
well,
right?
I'm not blaming China.
You know, China China basically is the IMF nowadays, aren't they? When you really want to get into it, I mean, they already own the world. I mean, U.S. has so much debt to China that if China ever repossess, you know, they're just going to hand over the keys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's just,
So, you know, there's a plan behind the War of Women, right? And by taking women out of the workforce and by eliminating women's ability to control their own destiny, we don't have the ability to have a strong economy in Canada. And they're controlling the population and eliminating our ability to fight back.
Yeah. Well, I think Harper tends to forget that he came out of a woman. Women produce people, and they're the ones who are taking care of our children, right?
So, unfortunately, I think, the only value we have to Harper.
No, but I mean, if you cripple a woman, you're crippling all of her subsequent children. You're crippling everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Exactly. And production is on the floor. So,
oh, that was good, Sid.
Yeah. So let's look at a couple of different other ways to look at things. Let's go to Argentina.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
The case of Argentina is interesting in several respects. First, the crisis of 2001 was a crisis which was a result of austerity and contractionary policies, and coupled with their debt crisis, so that they were following the advice of the IMF and those who argued that they had to cut back on the fiscal deficit and reduce things. So they basically went into a recession from 1998 to 2001, and that completely discredited all the policies about austerity and about fiscal control. And so then after they had their debt crisis in 2001 and they defaulted on their debt, there was a real search for alternatives. And starting in 2003, with the election of Mr. Kirchner as president, they started a process of focusing much more on spending in the country, targeting pro-poor spending, or a lot of social spending, a lot on infrastructure. And they said they wouldn't pay their debt to the external banks until they had reduced the poverty level. The poverty level of 2002 had reached 56% of the population, with unemployment of about 28%. So Kirchner, both here at the New School and when he spoke in 2003 and 2004, but also in the country, made the very strong statement, we're not going to take care of the external world until we take care of home first, which is our priority. So this actually prepared them for the global crisis of 2008, because they now understood that spending and policies which balance the external and the local and the national and the focusing on the domestic market and keeping aggregate demand up, that really mattered. So when the Lehman Brothers crisis starts in 2008, Argentina immediately decides to subsidize employment, to keep people working. So while demand went down for some of their exports, the government went to firms and said that if you were going to, if you're thinking of cutting employment, cutting some of your workers, we'll help cover some of the costs of that labor force in a transition period. So unemployment did not go down precipitously as it's going down in many other countries in the world. And if you look at the GDP and unemployment numbers, or the employment numbers for 2008, 2009, 2010, you see that, for example, Brazil had a very sharp V. It sort of, things came down and went right back up. Argentina had a U. Mm. The United States went into an L and has kept going down. And Europe has done pretty much the same. So the response has actually been quite positive. Unemployment has never gone over 12-13% in this context.
So in 2001, you think like the myth of austerity measures and the hope of getting us economic recovery out of it was completely discredited in Argentina, so they had a different response the next time they faced it. Do you think the United States is still under that myth, or do you think that we have hope of a different economic outcome given the same austerity measures?
I think there's interest. I think there's a vigorous debate in the U.S. about whether austerity makes sense, and certainly Krugman is one of the people who's argued against it. But it's surprising to watch the Republicans and Democrats, and to a certain extent, even how Obama accepted the budget deficit argument without a bigger stimulus package, and stimulus has not worked as well as it could have.
And actually, in your presentation from SEPA's first austerity event in December, you have a great graph about the stimulus packages in 2008 and 2010, and the difference between the size and the percent of GDP between the stimulus in Argentina and the United States. And the United States is 5.9% of the GDP compared to Argentina's, which is 1.3%. Can you describe the difference in effect? Because the United States is spending more money as a percentage of their economy and seeming to not get much out of it.
Because Argentina was able, through the previous 5 years, to get the domestic market moving and to get all these multipliers working in the domestic market, and also to take advantage of some exports, but basically it was a domestic recovery. There's a narrative about Argentina which is interesting. It says Argentina was lucky, that Argentina's recovery was a result of soya exports to China. But in fact, if you look carefully at the numbers, you see that the export earnings don't come until 2004, and the recovery started at the beginning of the end of 2002.
So, austerity measures, I mean, if anybody that followed the Argentina issue and the Iceland issues as well, I mean, Argentina is very much, before their crisis, two crises ago, when they were practicing austerity and it did not work, I mean, they looked exactly like Canada looks right now.
Yeah.
Right? They had a president who was, you know, shoveling out the resources as fast as he can. He was ditching legislation and protections, giving banks more power, more ability to move money in and out of the country. You know, all of the moves that Harper is making now, they made in Argentina. And basically, they sucked that country dry, and then they loaded all the money into Brinks trucks and headed out of the country.
Yeah.
You know, and the people woke up one morning, their banks were all closed, there's no money in the country, they were all starving to death, and they had to do it a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Canada's looking like. I mean, give us another 4 years of Harper, and we're that country.
Yeah, well, I don't know if Harper ever took basic economics while he was in school. I would hope so. But you see it in any economics class that the farther you lean towards capitalism, the more your society is going to be determined by market values. Those market values don't include people eating or people even surviving. They're just like, oh, some of the population dies off. Perfect, because we don't have enough jobs for all of you. So, you know, it doesn't consider any human values. So the farther you lean towards capitalism, the more problems that you're going to have. But the better the economy, so, you know, great.
Or not better the economy is, the better the people making money off the country are.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's the economy of the country, which actually includes social determinants and whether the population actually has any money. And, you know, if
we could say it does.
We can.
That's true.
This is true. And then, then we have Iceland, who sent out a warrant for bankers, and if they step foot and back in Iceland, they're going to arrest them.
Just hunt them down.
We hunt them down. And, you know, Argentina, you know, learned their lesson. In the second crisis, when the world went into their financial crisis in 2008, Argentina had already been there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, rather than cutting programs, rather than austerity measures, they pumped money into paying people.
Right.
That just makes the most sense. And it seems this austerity thing, it's just clouding people's minds. Like, it's confusing, I think, for a lot of people.
I mean, we look at the $3.1 billion that Harper gave banks in a bailout that he said didn't exist in Canada. And, you know, which is straight on the books. He did bail out the banks in Canada.
That sneaky devil.
Yeah, you know. And, you know, lie number 2,450,000, yeah. So, but he bailed out the money. $3 billion put into social programs for employment would have generated a whole pile more revenue in the country and saved our economy, rather than giving that $3 billion to the banks who just loaded it on a truck and took it out of the country.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think it's obvious to the left that when you invest in people, you have a better system. But I think Harper kind of, again, it's like he's living in his own world sometimes, I think.
Well, he is living in his own world, and he has his own jet. And, you know, and when he wants to, you know, enjoy people, he goes to Sweden.
Yeah.
Which the rest of us, we don't have that ability to do that kind of thing. You know, I don't think Iceland would actually let him in the borders.
I'm surprised that they let him out of Canada, really.
Yeah, you know, he's going to be like Bush, you know, he's not able to leave the country after he gets out. He's going to be stuck in the U.S. and Canada and have warrants around the world for his arrest.
Well, I mean, if you let the tar sands keep going, he is kind of like a world criminal. Somehow. Pollution travels.
Yeah, or the asbestos. I mean...
Oh, that's true.
You know, pushing asbestos on the world because, you know, Canadians are smart enough not to use the crap.
Harper.
We love Harper. You know, I always use the phrase around here, off with his head.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm comparing him to the crazy queen and...
Yeah, Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland.
We are definitely in a world of nonsense, that is for sure.
Yeah, so, you know, that is the world in which Canada lives, is the Alice in Wonderland, and some days I believe I'm Alice.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I ate the cake that made me really small, though.
Yeah, you know, and you know, women are getting smaller and smaller in Canada.
Drowning in a pool of our own tears.
So, guys, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. It's been a wonderful conversation, and hopefully our audience has learned a little bit about, you know, there are different ways to do things out there, and hopefully Joe's listening, and I doubt it.
But coming for you, Joe.
Coming for you. You know, I actually
see you on the 14th.
I love his diversity issues and his 13th? In his 13th. Programs, but, you know, he also didn't read the economic textbook. So, anyways, guys, thank you so much for joining us here on Between the Margins.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Michelle.
Thank you to all of the people that produce the clips that we have on our show, and thank you for YouTube for existing. If you want to hear this show and all shows like it, there's a wonderful summary of women's issues in Canada that that you can hear at www.betweenthemargins.ca. And I hope that you all have your happily ever after, however that looks like to you.